So this is what we saw yesterday. So we've been quantizing a constraint system that has all these weird, well, maybe not so common properties. But remember that we are still talking about gravity, right? So we should be able to get some, well, we could be able to get some geometrical information at the level, or at least something that looks like geometrical information at the level of this quantum theory. So remember, we have already fluxes and holonomies as our variables. So we saw that inspired in the length of a curve, because our operators, well, the fluxes and the holonomies in this case are defined in curves. So inspired in this just calculus expression, and remembering that this metric can be expressed in terms of these triads, we can figure out what our expression for a length would be, a length operator. So then we want to see how this operator acts on the basic states of our, at least of our Hilbert space that it's just an edge. So what we remember is that we already know how this E acts on the operators, on the states, on the bases. So then we see that the operator length square is going to go like E square. So that's where it comes, this C operator appears, that it's going to go like D square, like this Wigner coefficients, right? Or matrices square. So by chairs, well, and this is, we can see that this operator actually commutes with the Ds. So then by Chair's lemma, we can say that C is proportional to the identity. And this is like in angular momentum in usual quantum mechanics, that the J square, it's a Casimir operator. And it has eigenvalues j plus times j plus 1. And you can show it just like you show it in quantum mechanics. So then remember that this C was D squared, that it's proportional to E squared. So then our operator length square is going to act in the basis as the basis is an, well, are eigenvectors of this operator, and they will have eigenvalues j plus 1. So that is kind of telling us that maybe at least this notional length would be quantized. Remember, this is an operator in an edge. So now we're going to tensor product all the edges, all the Hilbert spaces in the edges, to get a graph. So what I thought was convenient to remember right now before going further is that this is still not our image. This is still not where we are. This could be just an interpretation, but I think it helps to visualize what we're doing. So we have a graph that is this green object. And this is where the holonomies are. This is where we compute our holonomies. But remember that in order to get rid of this delta that was bothering us, the Dirac delta, we defined the fluxes. We wanted to smear some variable, so we defined the fluxes. And we put the fluxes along a curve that just intersects where you're computing the holonomy in one point. So you could see this as this image. So the holonomies are computed along the graph, and the fluxes are computed along this dual graph that I'm putting here in white. A curious thing is that see that the length of an edge in the graph, so the length of a green edge, is computed by computing something, the E's in the dual graph. So it's like computing the length of this edge will be the gives you the geometrical information about this edge. Okay, and also I wanted to say just quickly that this is, remember that we're working in 2+1, and we did a big rotation. So then our group, our initial symmetry group was SO21. And now after the big rotation, we have SO3. And remember that we're looking for elements of the Lie algebra of SO3, and that's why we are using SU2. Okay, so, and remember the holonomy, and this, the holonomy is an element of SU2. So then SU2 is a compact group, so it has a discrete spectrum. That's where this comes from. But if we didn't do the big rotation, we would continue working with this. And this would lead us to a non-compact group. And then we wouldn't have a discrete spectrum. So this is something to think about. OK, and that's all.
Yeah, so about the Lorentzian case, it's a result for the geometrical operator that indeed it's not everything is discrete. It depends, you have to distinguish if you're talking about space-like or time-like geometries. But yeah, and there are kind of different results. So yeah, it's not only that. But in our case, indeed, it's true that the fact that it's discrete comes from the gauge group we have that is SU2 and which is compact. So where are we today? So Alicia is very in a hurry to get this nice triangulation. And it's what we're going to get today. So she already drew the drawing, so this is nice. Because so indeed, so right now we have been focusing on one edge of. So this is what we call the what will is going. So what is green is what is going to be what we call the spin network in quantum gravity. And indeed, if we choose a specific spin network, meaning that you can see that the one that has been drawn here is a spin network with only 3 valent vertices. So in this specific case, once we will have imposed the Gauss constraint, this this specific graph can be seen as dual as to a triangulation, okay? And maybe this is going to help a bit what is the meaning of this graph, because now you can kind of understand your graph indeed as giving you an approximation. You imagine that now you have a 2D surface, and you want to kind of describe this 2D surface. You can approximate this 2D surface, 2D surface in terms of small triangles glued together. And all the information about this triangulation can be found in the dual graph, which is our spin network, okay? So this is kind of a picture maybe that can help. Of course, in loop quantum gravity, first, we do not introduce triangulation as a regularization of our surface. It's really come up as a result. We do not discretize the surface. It's just come up more as a result. And the other thing I need to mention is that indeed, so in 3D, working with a graph dual to triangulation will be totally fine because it's a topological theory, so it's going to be graph invariant. But in 4D, so 3+1, it's not clear. Since we don't have a complete theory, of course, we cannot say anything, but a priori, it won't be the same as working with only arbitrary graph or working with only graph dual to triangulations. But it helps to get a nice geometrical picture to work with graph dual to triangulation. So let's see now. So right now, we are not yet there, meaning that even if I draw for you a graph with 3 edges, it's not at least the geometrical information that I have right now is does not tell me that I have a dual triangle, because what we're going to see is that this is really what the Gauss constraint is going to tell you. And yeah, just to clarify, this length operator is indeed giving you the length of the dual edge. So we see that it's a first geometrical information, and adding the Gauss constraint is going really to add a closure constraint for this triangle, characterized with three edges, where the length can be characterized by three different operators here. But again, all the information in quantum gravity can be found in the graph, so you don't really need to think about the dual graph. It can help if you want. But all everything is, you have all the information you need in the graph, and the decoration you add to this, okay? So the spin representation for the edges, and we're going to see that adding the Gauss constraint is going to give some intertwiners at the nodes. So let's go to the last step of the Dirac program, which is to get the physical physical Hilbert space, okay? So today, I'm not sure we will have time to consider both constraints, but at least I want to do carefully the Gauss constraint. So the idea is now, so we have this kinematical Hilbert space that is this tensor product of for a given graph. So I'm going to work for a given graph. And now the idea is to act with the Gauss constraint, to implement the Gauss constraint at the quantum level. And I don't know if you remember the expression of the Gauss constraint, but it's kind of messy here. You have some kind of derivative of your triad, and then you have some input. Yeah, it can be seen as it's a covariant derivative for E. And so here we have this derivative. So it's not going to be simple to write this as operators. But what is nice about this constraint is that we have a nice geometrical interpretation. Okay, so instead of starting from this expression, what we're going to do is to use the geometrical interpretation. And remember that this generates internal rotation. And we have seen our nullonomy is going to, so here what we're going to do is that the quantum theory, we consider the kind of exponentiated version of this Gauss constraint, okay? So meaning that we want to consider finite version of our transformation. Here you know that the Gauss constraint, you see it's going to generate infinitesimal transformation. But here we're going to use, we expect that even finite transformation can be implemented. And if you remember, what is the gauge transformation? So the finite gauge transformation. Gauge transformation on the holonomy. What do we get? So for a given edge, h of e, which is oriented, so I'm going to denote s of e, the source vertex, and t of e, the target vertex, then you remember that it's going to transform differently on the left and right. So here, I have a group element at the vertex t. G minus 1 at the vertex, the source vertex. Okay, so since our state we are working with, so our function, we are working with function over the group, SU2. Okay, so what does it mean for our state now? So you remember that we can write, so we choose the holonomy representation for our state, meaning that for a given edge. So how this is going to transform, this can be rewritten. So if now we want an invariant state, what does it mean? This means that we want a state So now I'm moving h, that is going to be invariant under the left and right translation. Okay, so left by the group G inverse, okay, if you remember the convention, and the right translation with, again, the same acting on this state. Okay, so this is what we try imposing, saying that a state is going to be invariant under gauge transformation. Finite gauge transformation means that we want a state that is going to be invariant under this, the left and right action of the group in this way. So let me maybe just rewrite the definition here. So here it's F. And the right one okay. So how are we going to implement this Gauss constraint? So here, and again, what we want to implement is really finite gauge transformation, invariance under finite gauge transformation. So a way to implement that, and I'm not sure if you already have seen that, so if you haven't, maybe we can go back to a simplest example to see how it works. So what we're going to do now is to implement this constraint, it's to implement, a kind of projector on, of course, the subspace of states satisfying the Gauss. By averaging over the group. So it's what we call a group averaging thing. So here, SU2 at for both ends. Of the edge. So what does it mean here for a state? If we consider just, let's just focus for an edge first, and we're going to see that indeed it's going to be too simple. So we want to kind of define this kind of object. So here it's kind of just right now a notation. So here it's just living on a given edge for the moment. And the idea is we want to express that as an integral over the finite transformation induced by the constraint. So here, for us, the finite transformation induced by the constraint are given by this thing. So, and we want to write this as an integral over the group. So I'm going to write the expression, and then if it's not clear, then maybe we can okay, so this is the way, so this is just for a given edge. How are we going to define this action? So are you familiar with this kind of group averaging thing or not? You are maybe, but not because everyone else or? Maybe what we can, so we could do it explicitly on the case of the, we could go back to the parameterized particle, but maybe it's going to be too long. So what I can do, so, but then as an exercise, I'm going to do one first part. So you can do it explicitly for the parameterized particle. So if you remember the parameterized particle, the constraint we had was just the Schrödinger, implementing the Schrödinger equation, okay? So we're here, the idea, so I write you what what would this mean in this case? And then we can see on an even simpler example how this work. So what you would write in this case would be, you want to impose the constraint C on your wave function. So what I'm telling you is that here we're using this group averaging. So, and you can see that, you remember, what is delta of x? You know that delta of x, if you kind of take the Fourier transform of the delta of the function delta of x, you get an integral. So here is kind of a generalization of that, except that we're going to have some operators here. So here, h bar of a parameter s in front of my constraint c that was written p, the operator of p of t plus my small h, where this small h was just the term in pq squared divided by 2m. Okay, so it's kind of, it's Hamiltonian for the non-parametrized particle. Okay, so this is what I mean by this small h. So here I'm doing the same thing as before. So I'm acting. So as you remember, the Gauss, the constraint is always the generator of infinite transformation. So now I want to go to finite transformation. So I kind of exponentiate this transformation. And I'm doing this integration over. And you can do that explicitly yourself. And we're going to do one step together. So here there is some work to do. So I'll let you do this work here. But what you get at the end, just to give you an idea, because it's not exactly maybe what you would obtain when, so here it's over R3 we're integrating. Where now you will see that this function is indeed a solution of Schrödinger equation, which is so a solution of our constraint. Okay, a solution of the constraint was a solution of the Schrödinger equation at fixed at a fixed variable r. And then you kind of summing over, okay? So here it's kind of, instead of just having one solution, you have a superposition of solution, but so it's still a physical state, okay? So what you get here is not as if you were just solving the constraint explicitly as we did in the first part of the class, where we find only one solution of the Schrödinger equation. Here you're going to find solution of the Schrödinger equation kind of labeled by a parameter r, and you sum over all of them, so which means that you take like kind of a superposition of all solution. And this is indeed, again, a solution. So this is kind of what happened when you do that. But maybe what we can do is just look at, because I'm going to use it also, I'm using also going to, so this is for you to do. And here we're going to do together explicitly an even simpler example that I'm going to reuse when we going to also impose the flatness constraint at some point. So let's do it now. So you know that if I just consider, so let's consider a very simple system where I just have one particle. So then the momentum associated to this particle is going to generate translation in Q. Okay, so let's say I just have a system with Q and PQ. And so I can have a constraint P of Q that we expect that it generates translation in Q. And so what does it mean now to write the finite transformation associated to this one is by, again, exponentiated this constraint. So and so let's see that explicitly. So if now I write PQ, which is going to act on the state wave function depending on this Q. Okay, so here I'm looking at, now, what are the finite transformation? So Here I'm looking at finite gauge transformation associated to a given constraint. So how can you see that this is indeed generating translation? So what you do, so you replace this, what does it mean? It means that we are looking at this object. And so now this is an exponential of an operator. So the way to deal with that is to look at the series expansion. And here is just now the Taylor expansion of this function evaluated at q plus s. Okay, so indeed this is the exponentiated version of our constraint, indeed generate translation here. And if now the idea is what you want to do is to find state that satisfies this equation. Okay, so the simpler solution that you see, because this is a derivative with respect to q, is just that what you're going to get is a solution of that are going to be states that are constant in q, okay? So independent of. So here you get function, wave function. So you see that if you want to do the barometric particle explicitly, you also have now a translation in time, okay, coming from this momentum. So it's going to be exactly the same thing here. So this is if we were just trying to impose that, we find this solution. Let's see now what does it mean if we try to impose that again as a projector onto the constraint. So if we try to define this kind of thing acting on a given wave function. So it's going to be very similar to just what I wrote before. Okay. And here, what I want to write now is just so I get this okay, so I'm integrating over all the. In fact, what I'm doing is averaging over the gauge orbit, okay, of my constraint, where the gauge orbit is q for s. And what I get here is indeed this. So if we compare this result with this result, indeed, and also now with what we were expecting from just solving this constraint, so we were expecting function constant in q. So here it's indeed what we get, because you can do the change of variable q plus s. And then you get this is indeed constant in q. But you see that here what you're really doing is kind of averaging over your gauge orbit. Okay, so this is what we in spirit, what we're doing here. And I will come back to this example when we're going to deal with the flatness constraint, because the flatness constraint, we know that they generate translation. So as for this example, the gauge orbit we're considering is going to be non-compact, okay? And so we're going to see that when we want to go to the physical phase space, again, as for the parameterized particle where we're dealing with a non-compact gauge group, we're going to end up with an issue of defining, not an issue, but we need to find a way to define the physical inner product that is not going to be the kinematical inner product. And using this procedure is going to give us kind of a way to do it. Okay. But here for SU2, this is fine. It's a compact gauge symmetry. So we can just look at this and see what we get. OK, any questions here? Yeah.
Second example, the group is translations.
Yeah.
And for the first example, what is the group that we're averaging over?
So here we were also averaging over because the transformation we were the transformation was reparametrization. Okay, so it's kind of also a gauge. So this is a transformation, so which was very, which is very close to kind of a DFAO symmetry here. Okay, so let's now see how we get these nice triangles here, imposing the Gauss constraint using this way. So let's first, so here it's on one edge, so let's first look more in closer to this expression and simplify this. And in fact, we're going to see that imposing the Gauss constraint on one edge is kind of trivial. And the first non-trivial case we will have to consider is at least a node or a vertex with three edges. But let's first simplify. So I'm starting from here, okay? This was just to explain a bit this this expression. So let's write it explicitly. So here, I have integrating over 2, SU2, and I'm looking at this. So if I'm now evaluating that on a group element, okay, so what I'm doing is looking at this object and integrating over. And so can you see why this thing is going to be trivial, meaning that it's just going to be a constant number? Do you remember what are the property of zero R measure? So here it's the R measure. And which? Sorry?
It's Gaussian invariant.
Yeah, well, it's invariant. So here we're integrating over G1, G2. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's left and right. It's invariant under left and right translation. So if you call, for example, you do this change of variable, G1 prime, then you have that dg1 prime dg1. Okay, so here you just can really just simplify this expression as again, this is just a constant number. It's in particular, it's independent of H, so it's not the case of one H is the gauge invariant space is just going to be trivial. Okay, what we want to determine now is the space of solution of this constraint. Okay, so here it's kind of trivial for a given edge. So space of solution. And if we consider just, so two edges, I'm not going to do it explicitly, but you can understand what is going to happen. So if I have two edges, meaning that meet at a given vertex, here at this given vertex, the gauge transformation I'm going to have is for the H, the G1 is going to be a H, and for the G2 is going to be a H inverse, or the other way around. No, I think this way. So any invariant function is going to be of the form where you take the product of G1, G2. And because now if you insert the gauge transformation, it's going to cancel here. And G1, G2, because of the property of the holonomy, it's just the G associated to the full edge, so you're back to just a one edge case. Okay, so it's not going to be interesting either. So this is what's the case for a vertex, two valent vertex. So the first non-trivial thing is going to be a three valent vertex. And here I'm going to choose the case with, let's say, outgoing maybe before doing that, so we can generalize So you see that here we're focusing on an edge, but we're going to see that in fact what is important is really the vertex, okay? Because at a given vertex, all the gauge transformation for this half, if you want, for all this edge at this, for these three edges at this vertex is going to be same group element acting here, and it's what is going to make that. It's going to give you something non-trivial, okay? Like here, you see that it's the same H here coming at this, because the gauge transformation is by associating a group element to a given vertex. So even if we want to, for a given, so I'm going to do this explicitly, but kind of if you want to generalize, so now we're going to talk about the Gauss constraint associated to a vertex V. And this, in terms of integral, can be written over, so it's just an integration over one group, SU2, okay? Because for this given vertex, it's going to be the same group, SU2, acting on all edges. And we're going to get some left action when E is going to be that as the vertex V is the target vertex of E, and some right action on some E prime edges when E prime is going such as V now is going to be the source vertex. Okay, so this means that here this operator is going to act on vertex V with as many edges as we want. And I'm going to get some left action here when this vertex is the target of my edge E, okay? So when it's an incoming edge, and for outgoing edges, I'm going to get, so my vertex now is my source. I'm going to get some right action. This is E prime. But explicitly, let's do it for the case of a three-valent vertices with three outgoing edges, E1, E2, E3. And so we have seen that I'm going to act with on this vertex with my Gauss expression on my basic state, okay? Where here I'm taking the tensor product from E equal 1 to 3 of this GI, MI, and I. And explicitly, what does it mean? What am I going to do? So I'm going to use what I wrote here, but in the specific case where it's only outgoing, so I'm only going to get some right action here, three of them. And so I'm going to use, so for E1, E3, still acting on this, I, and when we, so yesterday when we define the, so to compute the action of the E operator on this vector basis, since the E operator can be written as a right action, we determine what was the right action on this vector basis, so I'm going to use this result. So here, if you don't know where this comes from, so here, look at yesterday lecture notes. And we did the right action when we were looking also at to explain that a given edge has two magnetic numbers and one can be attached to the source and target vertex. So here, what I get is I get still this integration of the group SU2. Now, let's write explicitly that I have a summation over P1, P2, P3. And I'm going to end up with some Wigner matrices here, P1, N1. P3, M3 over H. So this integration is going to be for the three groups element. And now I get my vector has been changed to the tensor product. So J is unchanged. M is PI. And is that correct? No, it's not. It's the other way around. Or? No. So M. Okay, so now I'm going to use some recoupling theory here, and it is, so I guess you don't know that, but if you look at the kind of textbook over SU2 recoupling theory, this integration of three Wigner matrices over one given group element is well known. Okay, so now what I'm going to compute is this object. So here, this is from recoupling theory. And you get a kind of nicer interpretation of, so what we're going to, the object we're going to get is what we're going to call the intertwiner. And maybe what was, the way it was presented in the tutorial yesterday maybe give you a kind of nicer, really see that from you get some tensor of given spin and you recouple them to get an invariant tensor, meaning that it's you want an object of kind of a scalar, okay? So spin zero. And I think it was more clear in the tutorial that was presented yesterday that in the calculation we're doing. So if you want to have a kind of better intuition of what are these intertwiners doing, what does it mean that they intertwine? I advise that you have a look at the tutorial again. So here, if I have a kind of integration like this, this is well known. And this is given by some Wigner 3J symbol. Okay. Sorry, 1, 2, 3, M1, M2. M3, and in fact, it's a product of two in this case. So what are these objects? These objects are what we call 3J. So are you familiar with this Wigner 3J symbol? Or? Yeah, you, but this doesn't count. Okay. Some in the room doesn't count, so kind of half of the room doesn't count, so it's kind of, so I need the answer from the other. Okay, so here, yeah, this is what we call a 3J, so in which order do you say? Wigner 3J, sometimes M symbol, and in fact, you know them very well, because they are just a kind of a normalization of some Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Okay, it's just they have kind of nicest orthonormal property because they're kind of already normalized. So here you get this minus one. No. M3, so here you get some sine. And then you get the dimension of the first representation, J1. And this is related to the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. The thing is that usually the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient is not very kind of symmetric in the sense that, yeah, you consider you're coupling together two angular momentum. And then you kind of find what is the total angular momentum, and it's, but here you really have a kind of nice symmetry when you exchange some of the columns, but it also comes with sign. So M2. I don't know how you use to write your Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. I'm not sure it's the best way. So this is what I did at the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Okay, so this was just to relate to kind of what we know. So if now we kind of normalized, so if we go back to this and normalize this state, so here what we get is a state that is invariant under SU2, internal SU2 rotation. So you see that the SU2 is really rotating the three, is acting on the three edges together, okay, with the same rotation. So now from this thing, you get a state which is invariant under rotation at V based on the three edges with this source vertex V. And so what you get, but here it's normalized. So normalized state. And so it's just associated just to this vertex again. It's not the full spin network. So what we get is sum over P1, P2, P3 of this 3G symbol. Acting on this. And so, and the state associated to a three-valent vertex invariant under SU2 rotation or the Gauss constraint is unique up to normalization. Okay, so here it's a unique solution. Then, of course, we could look at vertices of higher valence. But yeah, you have some kind of also recoupling theory that is going to tell you that, for example, for a four-valent vertex, you can write them in terms of combination of these two three-valent with some coefficient here that are some 6G things. And or this way. So you have two ways of recoupling this four-valent, also with some coefficient here. And you sum over this new spin. So yeah, once you have the kind of, when you have the three valent vertices, you can kind of build all the other. But of course, the state of the space of four valent vertices is not unique as it is here. It's you get more solution, and the higher you go, the more solution you get. So here it's up to normalization. Okay, but now what I'm going to do is put all these pieces together to see what we call a spin network, okay? So meaning that it's going to be the state satisfying the Gauss constraint, so it's, but for a given graph, not only for a given vertex, or you write that, so it's kind of very simple. But then what I want to do quickly is kind of give you that indeed now the picture of Alicia is kind of true, because in this thing, if you go to the infinitesimal level, can be really written as a kind of closure constraint for a triangle. Okay, so at least the quantum equivalent of a closure constraint for a triangle. So this is just what I want to do quickly. But before that, yeah, and here, in fact, in this specific case of this, what we call this projector here is a proper projector, meaning that projector squared is the projector, and this comes from the normalization property of this 3J symbols, okay? So which is kind of nice here. Um, Okay, so just from vocabulary, so the notion of, now we can introduce notion of intertwiner. And more precisely, and spin network. And so here I'm going to denote this as an intertwiner, and it's just going to be this 3J symbol, okay? But again, so for a three valent vertex, an intertwiner is just a 3J symbol. And so what does it mean? An intertwiner means that it's intertwining, so it's an intertwiner from the tensor product of these three representations to the trivial representation. Okay, so this, what this object means here, it's intertwining these three things to a trivial representation. Okay, and so now spin network state are kind of SU2 invariant functions, so where the SU2 invariance is imposed at each vertex. Okay, and so you can write them. So here it's going to be SU2 even to the power of v, where v is the number of vertices, so our invariant function. This is what we call the spin network state. And so here, again, it's something associated to a graph, oriented graph, sorry. And it's colored by some spin representation, so spin representation, and associated to each edge, so maybe GE, and intertwiner associated to each vertex. And if you evaluate that on group element, okay. So E, big E is the number of edges of my graph. This is my graph. V is the number of vertex, E is the number of edges. Here, what I can write is kind of sum over some of the indices that are going to be. And then I'm going to take the product over all the edges of, where here I'm evaluating, I'm using my, vector basis, and here I'm going to have a product of intertwiner at each vertices. Where V is equal to, is such as V is the, so here I'm missing some prime, I think. So when it's the source of a given edge E, or V can be the target of the target vertex of E prime. I guess here I should have some E prime. And yeah, so this kind of maybe a bit abstract, but next lecture, we're going to write an explicit example, and on this explicit example applies a, so meaning we're going to start with a given graph, write explicitly what does it mean to have an intertwiner for this spin network on this graph, written for this graph, and then impose the flatness constraint. Okay, so this kind of expression will become more clear once we do an explicit example. For today, just I have 5 minutes to kind of give you the geometrical picture that Alicia was giving you today. So if you remember, this flux operator, okay, are given by this left invariant derivative, or they can also be written using the derivative as a right translation. Okay, so indeed, again, it's what we are saying, the flux operator is the infinitesimal version kind of the right translation. And so if we consider again this case with only outgoing vertices, you remember that the way we impose the Gauss constraint is by looking at this product of operator. So very briefly, this can be also an infinitesimal version of the transformation induced by this. So this is a way to impose the Gauss constraint. And so now, if we look at infinitesimal, I guess I have too many I here. My version of the translation induced by the Gauss constraint. What I guess is a sum. You could rewrite that kind of a sum over the E associated to. So this could be kind of the infinitesimal version . And so what is going to tell you is that indeed the total flux through a vertex is zero. And if you remember, I think I recall it, what was the Gauss constraint? What is this Gauss constraint? Is is a kind of divergence of the flux vector field is telling you that the divergence of the flux vector field is vanishing. So you see that this expression is quite in accordance with the classical Gauss constraint. And also, what does it mean? So now, if we go back to this vertex here, okay, we can now draw the dual to each edge. And this expression, so if you remember, indeed, as Alicia remind us, this E are defined on the dual edge. And also, the length operator is giving you a measure of this dual edge. Okay. So here, with this operator, they characterize this edge. And here, this summation here, at least classical, if you go to the, before talking about operator, if you really go to the discrete level, okay, you remember that we went from this continuous variable to this H flux, holonomy flux variable, kind of discrete. You get the same expression, but kind of vectorial. So you can really see that as the closure of a triangle. Okay, so what you really get is at the discrete level, but classically, is some discrete geometry, and the holonomy flux, still classical, characterized completely, for example, once the Gauss constraint is imposed, you get something like this as a Gauss constraint. It's really the closure of this triangle, and the length of this edge is given by the norm of this, and you can characterize angle between taking the tensor product of these two objects. So you can do something similar at the quantum level, define the quantum angle operator, and you get some consistency here. So here, everything you have with the Gauss constraint, you know kind of everything about what we can call intrinsic geometry. And we're going to see, so it will be on Monday, that what is the flatness constraint is going to tell you is more about extrinsic geometry, because it's going to tell you how you glue together these triangles, and in such a way that, so classically, what is going to tell you is that the flatness constraint is going to tell you that you want to glue this triangle in such a way that the geometry you get can be embedded in a flat 3D geometry. Okay, so this is kind of the geometrical interpretation of this constraint, and you can see that really if you go to the infinitesimal level of this Gauss constraint, which tell you that the total flux through a vertex has to be zero. Okay.